Okay, now we're recording, so we're formally here in our Crips meeting, the 1st in June. And yeah, as you all read in the email that Andy sent out, we're glad to have Matt here, and he will talk about the what it takes to apply and to successfully get lectureships in the UK, as you probably. Is that right? To you, please.
Yes, I should probably just talk about the UK system, as it's the one that I know best, of course. So thank you very much for my latest invite to come and talk to you. I'll start in the usual way with a few disclaimers. The first one is about the nature of what I'm going to talk about, that clearly this is just me as I see things developing. You could probably stick any number of different academics from the department in front of you, and they would all say different things on the same topic. So this is a set of personal reflections about the way that the job market currently looks for young academics coming to the end of their PhDs, and also what you need to do within that job market to try to successfully negotiate your way through the application and the interview stage. The second disclaimer is that I'll be as honest as I can. I don't think there's any point at all sugarcoating it for you. That you will know that there are things going on within the profession at the moment, and that those things are maybe not the most positive developments in the world for any of us. So with that in mind, I will try to just call it exactly as I see it. And I'm not going to be overly kind and spare you from any of the harsh realities that I see out there. So that's what I'm going to do. Let me start with a few comments about context, because that's where the second disclaimer, I think, automatically leads to. And the obvious contextual question is, well, are there any jobs? Because if there aren't any jobs, it doesn't really make a great deal of sense for me to sit here and tell you how you might go about trying to get one. And my answer to that is yes. That's good, isn't it? Although it's a yes but, because of course I can never come in with a completely positive frame of mind. Always have to be there with my qualifications. So let me say why I think the general answer is yes for a start. Because I'm sure that you could get lots of people from our department sitting here instead of me, and they wouldn't go that far. They would just say no. They would tell you that the whole of the job market has dried up, it's completely seized up. And it's become, in many senses, inoperative. I don't think that's right, although I'm not going to hide the fact from you that clearly we're moving through a period of uncertainty. And that period of uncertainty has a number of different origins. Firstly, huge budget cuts are already in train. There's a suggestion of anything up to 25 to 30% of the Hefke budget will be trimmed over the next few years. I don't think this is a secret, so I'm going to say, even though the tape recorder is on, and of course nobody's going to listen to this from the university, so I can't get in trouble anyway, the university has been undertaking a number of formal models to see how much of it survives given different forecasting scenarios. And the top meaning worst, forecasting scenario that they've had to put themselves through is to imagine what would happen if the university was forced to swallow 25% cuts in its Hefke budget. Hefke is the Higher Education Funding Council for England, and it's Hefke that pays us for all of our undergraduate students. So if you think that the core business of a university is just teaching its swathes of undergraduate students, at one level you wouldn't be wrong, but at another level, as I hope I'm going to demonstrate, things aren't all that bad, certainly for some institutions, because that's not exactly what their core business now is. Well, anyway, on these projections, we all survive. We probably all survive in slightly trimmed down form. There won't be as much of us in any particular department, but no department actually gets closed, even under a 25% Hefke cut. One of the reasons for that here is that Warwick is not all that exposed to Hefke money. Only about, I think it's 22% of our overall finances come through the Hefke budget. There are other institutions in the country. Here's two just off the top of my head, Leeds and Sheffield, both of whom have hefty exposure over 40% of their budget. So if you can imagine, if 25% of hefty money disappears, and disappears pretty much overnight, that's one-tenth of the income, over one-tenth of the income of those institutions. And institutions that are used to running just at the break-even point don't survive that intact. So we're not looking too bad, but other places are looking much more exposed than we are. And the general message is that these huge budget cuts are already in train and will have an effect. There's absolutely no way around that. I'm not entirely sure that this will be a negative effect for you lot. I actually think there are some positives for you from these impending budget cuts. And that's that universities will seek to trim their wages bill. And of course, one of the advantages that you have, and that I don't, is your relative youth. I envy you your youth. You might envy me my job and my salary, but I envy you your youth. And in turn, one of the things to university managers that your relative youth means is that you're also relatively cheap. This isn't, at one level, the best message that you could ever find out about yourself. But of course, academic salaries are structured in such a way that the longer and longer you get into the job, the more money you get paid. So if you're shuffling off someone who's been in the job for 20 or 30 years, you can easily afford to replace them with someone just entering the profession while still making a cost saving. Now, this might not be anything to cause you to do great cartwheels, coming to the realisation that you are relatively cheap labour compared to what you might be replacing. But I do think this means there will still be throughput in the academic jobs market. So for all the people that say there's money going out of the system, that means there will be no jobs, I don't think that's right. It might be overall that there are no net new jobs, but of course for you in the situation that you're coming up to, just about to finish your PhDs in the next couple of years, that sort of just about to finish your PhDs, you don't need there to be net new jobs for positions to come up for you. You just need there to be throughput through the academic labour market. And if this means that more expensive older people are being moved aside for early career scholars such as yourself, then from the university's perspective, that's going to be a cost saving. But in the overall perspective, that will still be the same number of bodies in the job doing the work. So I think there are reasons for you to be positive in this respect. The labour market is not just going to stop. There won't be huge numbers of brand new jobs, but of course you don't need them to be brand new jobs for there to be jobs available for you to apply for. So hopefully when you hear a number of the doommongers saying that the academic labour market has ceased to operate in any functional sense, don't believe them, because it's not that straightforward. There'll be any number of things that universities are trying to do to shed higher end labour and to replace higher end labour with early career scholars. That sounds better than the cheap version, which is of course what I'm actually saying. Another factor here of uncertainty: we don't know whether the research excellence framework exercise will now take place. We certainly don't know when it will take place. If it had gone to schedule, it would have taken place with the census date at the end of 2012. We now know that it's not going to be that soon, because there are further reviews coming as to whether the process is functional in such a way that it makes sense to run it. We don't actually even know whether it will run. If the government is as committed to cost cutting as it says it is, the £50 million minimum that Hefty says it needs to run the research excellence framework exercise might just be an easy saving to make. So I think the message that I'm getting from University Central Command, or however I should describe them, is that they're increasingly unsure that the research excellence framework will actually run. I hate to say it, but from your perspective, I think this is bad news. I think from your perspective, you would want the research excellence framework to run and to run as quickly as possible. Because when its final dates are announced, this is always a trigger for the academic transfer market to kick in. And when the academic transfer market kicks in, there are lots of jobs created in the wake of the move of big name people from one institution to another. So one of the things that you really need to happen is for the government to decide that the research excellence framework exercise will go ahead, and will go ahead almost as planned. I can imagine just how many of my colleagues would be throttling me if they heard me say that, because for any of them that are still worrying about what their individual ref submission will be, they're delighted about the prospect that it might not go ahead. I think you're in a completely different position to them, though, and that strategically it would be much better for you if it were to go ahead. So, those are my contextual observations. That's the basis of the yes. Yes, there will be jobs, and I think there will be more of them the sooner that REF runs. And I think there will be double more of them if REF runs in the same way that the RE ran last time, activating a transfer market, which then has these knock-on effects further and further down the profession. Now for the but. But all jobs now are hugely competitive. Sorry, but that's just the way it is. And this is for a number of reasons, I think. The first reason is that good graduate schools are now turning out more PhDs than ever before. You don't need to be a genius here to do the maths, do you? If we're turning out more and more highly qualified PhD students with great doctorates, then there are going to be more and more highly qualified people looking for each job. Equally, something has changed very significantly over the last few years. The REF culture itself is such that the very best graduating PhD students now have much more on their research CVs than used to be the case. If I think back to when I was a completing PhD student, I had three pieces on my research CV, and I was lucky enough that I pretty much had departments fighting over me. That was very unusual then, to have three pieces of published work on your research CV. And this is only 10 years ago, so it's not all that long ago. Hold on, there was no self-deprecating joke there. That was just a reporting of fact. That's almost 10 years ago. Things have changed, and changed considerably. I can look back just a few weeks to when we had the series of appointments to make of early career scholars. And I was involved in two of the shortlisting panels. I'll tell you more about what they do in a minute. And it staggered me. It was frightening, really, just how many people who had markedly better CVs than I did when I had all these departments fighting over me 10 years ago, who didn't get anywhere near our shortlists. People with full REF submissions, for early career scholars, presuming that the REF will run, the current assumption is that you will be required to submit two individual pieces of work. That's all. People with two, three, four, five journal articles on their CV, for a variety of reasons, getting absolutely nowhere near our shortlists. This makes me pleased to be as old as I am, because I will know that I will never be in the situation that you're faced with now. If that's the competition, then I'm afraid that's really quite daunting competition. Okay, it doesn't mean that jobs are closed off, but it does mean that particular types of jobs, jobs such as ones in a department as reputable as ours, become very, very difficult to get. Let me tell you a little bit about the breakdown of the applications that I saw a few weeks ago. The typical field is made up of different types of candidates. You will get the people who have not quite finished their PhD in that field. You'll get the people who have finished their PhD but have yet to get into a first academic job. As you would expect, all of these people to be in the field. But one thing that's very different from my day is that you now have people with 1, 2, possibly 3 years of postdoctoral fellowships, also looking for their first permanent academic post, also in the field. And you get that transfer market element as well. You get people looking to trade up that have got themselves in, they've got their feet under the desk somewhere, and now they're desperate to work in a top 10 department. And so a chance of, have I got the right number of fingers up now? Is that four? So the chance for those sorts of people to work within a department that's as good as ours is obviously very, very attractive for them. And I'm not sure 10 years ago you saw that same sense of people moving around and trying to engineer positions for themselves in top 10 departments, that there wasn't really that sense of where everyone fitted in the hierarchy. You just had a job and you were grateful for your job and you got on with it. I think it's very different now. Oh, there's also the fifth category. This will make you laugh. These are the no-hopers. The people who are applying for an academic job within a global academic market but don't think that the fact that they've got absolutely no academic background is an impediment to them trying to get that job. Had some absolute beauties this time around. Someone, for instance, that said, I've read newspapers for 45 years, so I think I'm very well placed to get your lectureship in political theory. As a member of the political theory shortlisting committee, I have to say we didn't agree with this particular applicant. We didn't think that they were very well placed for our lectureship in political theory. So you do get some slightly strange applications. So what you will know for a start is that you're going to be in front of all of those people. So that's cause for success, cause for celebration. Okay, in our last lot of jobs, I think we probably had about 5% of the applications in this purely speculative mode. The ones that I cruelly called the no-hopers, the people who just didn't have a CV that gave any sense at all that they could do the job, but thought that, oh, that sounds like fun, probably quite easy as well. I'm sure those academics, they don't do much, so I'll get in for a bit of that. So that's about 5%. Probably somewhere between a quarter and a third, maybe just over a quarter, were from people who were clearly, clearly very, very promising, but didn't have any publications at all. As I'll go on to say, publications almost certainly now are a must to really get yourself noticed and to make your CV jump out of the pile when shortlisting committees are going through them. More than anything else, it's what's on the research CV in terms of publications that makes the difference. Now, this leaves about two-thirds of the applications as what we might call serious applications. And I'm not saying the people who are still at the very formative stage of their career and have great PhDs just about to be finished but don't have any publications are not serious scholars and are not serious about their work. All I'm talking about in that respect is what goes through the mind of people on the shortlisting committee as to the people that they're really going to think seriously about inviting for an interview. So about two-thirds of them. And of these people, as I've said before, lots and lots, almost all of them, all but four of them would have had full ref submissions at that stage in their career, but still not made it onto the shortlist. So it's difficult. Let me tell you how jobs are created, and then that might help you to make sense of some of these numbers. So when I say that two-thirds of these are really serious applicants that we have to choose carefully between in terms of making the decision about shortlisting, you must be sitting there thinking, aha, but two-thirds of how many? And it wasn't a routine number of applications that we had for our different jobs. I can tell you how jobs are created, and that might help you to make sense of this. For our two security studies jobs that we just appointed, we had just under 50 applications for each. So of the two-thirds that were, in my term, serious applications, that's what? That's somewhere between 35 and 40 that are really in with a chance. Yeah. For the IPE job we had, it was just over 50. I think it was 54 that I had to go through. So no, two-thirds of that is somewhere between 35 and 40. So my maths went astray for the previous one, but you get the sense. For the political theory job, I had to work through all of these as well. There were 96. And that sends, I think, a quantitative signal of what we already know, that there are bottlenecks in pretty much all parts of the subject field. In other words, many more qualified applicants than there are jobs available. But the bottlenecks are clearly more severe in some parts of the subject field than others. Why is there this disparity? Why does it make you more uncomfortable if you're sitting there as a political theorist to hear those numbers than as anything else? I did notice that Doug was the only one whose head instinctively went into his hands and the "oh no" came from him. And why, for instance, are the bottlenecks more severe in political theory? I think the answer has to do in the way in which jobs are created in the first place. And I also think it makes sense if I tell you a little bit about this. Well, firstly, there are positions that are made available as straightforward replacements. So if somebody retires or somebody says, "I'm not working here anymore, I've got a better job offer somewhere else," and they move on, then you can get positions that are introduced as straightforward replacements. This is often associated with covering the teaching need. If you've got someone who teaches core parts of your undergraduate programme and they suddenly go, then you find very quickly that you need somebody to cover that core part of your undergraduate teaching. Can't deliver the programme without that teaching, so you get someone in, a specialist in, to do that. So you get a straightforward replacement there. This is becoming increasingly unusual, though, to see jobs that are straightforward replacements. And this is one of the ways that the cost pressures and the budget pressures are coming to bear on us. Increasingly now, new jobs are created either, firstly, to service a strategic investment in a new centre or a new research group or a new initiative of some sort, perhaps one that covers an ESRC strategic challenge area. So the ESRC every 5 years will say, "We now have a list of new strategic challenge areas, and most of the research funding that we disperse will be conducted in one of these challenge areas." So what do departments then do? They try to make strategic investments in areas that directly map onto those. If you think of the way that this department changed before you got here, so you can't think of that, but if you listen to the academic members of staff who have been here for a while talking about the way that the department has changed, the significant difference in the department was the introduction of the security studies group that came pretty much from nowhere to being one of the major players within the department. And that was a strategic investment given to the department by the university to cover the fact that security, conflict and justice was designated an ESRC strategic challenge area for the period 2009 to 2014. And we all know why, because of how topical those sorts of issues are. So that's one way that new jobs get created. The other new way is linked to a business model associated with new streams of self-generated income. Probably didn't think you would come here and listen to me talk about business models, but that's the way. Don't be, because it's all superficial. But that's increasingly the way that we have to think about our own department. You might think, "Oh, they're just these old bookish style academics who couldn't organise their way into or out of a paper bag," but actually we have to make decisions on a daily basis related to developing core businesses or core business operations which produce new income streams for us. And the way to do that, primarily, as I'm sure you all know, is through taught postgraduate programmes. That was the interactive bit of the presentation, and you all messed up. You will have no other chance to say anything now because I'm in full flow. And you'll see from the way that we increasingly put on more and more programmes, more and more numbers, think of all the students, and we do still treat them as students, although at another level in terms of our departmental planning. Hate to say it, but it's nonetheless true, they are income. And the income that they generate serves to sustain many of the jobs of the academic members of staff that work here. In fact, by the time the hefty cuts come through, I suspect very strongly that we will make a loss on every one of our undergraduate students, that we will not be paid enough by HEFGE to actually service the teaching of any of our undergraduate students. In other words, we as a department will be subsidising the government for underpaying us for teaching undergraduate students. The cost-effective response to that would be to shut down our undergraduate programmes. I suspect that a university of our calibre would not be allowed to just say, right then, if you're not going to pay us properly for these people, we're not going to teach them. So we have to find ways of making new income, and taught postgraduate programmes are the primary way of doing that. And because of this, both the ESR strategic challenge areas and the ability to attract new taught postgraduate students, they prioritise certain bits of the subject field over others. And that's then reflected in where most of the new jobs are. And that subsequently gets reflected in an inverse way into where the bottlenecks in the labour market currently are. So the fact, for instance, that Doug's feeling the most uncomfortable because of the number of political theory applicants we have being much bigger than for the other jobs, is a reflection of the fact that there have been so few political theory jobs advertised in recent years, and that's because, with all the best will in the world, you could never run a flourishing MA programme in political theory and get the numbers who would be prepared to pay for that. Yeah. So what we find, which might be a good news for most of you, maybe not for Doug, is that anything, any bit of the subject field with the word international in front of, has been heavily involved in the growth areas of the profession in recent years. So international politics in general, international relations, security studies, international political economy, this is where the big MA programmes are. And because that's where the big MA programmes are, this is where the self-generated income through running those programmes translates into new jobs. And this might seem unfair in many ways to privilege certain bits of the subject field over others, but the decision that we're left with is that you either generate new income through those potential markets and therefore have new people, or you turn your back on that and don't have any new people. So I'm afraid it's a game that we all play, but it's a game that we're almost forced to play, I think. That's taken me rather longer than I expected. I will keep going now to actually talk about the process, if that's all right. Let me say something about job adverts and how job adverts come about in the first place, because this is also something that you probably don't know, but there's no reason for me to keep this from you. Well, the first thing to say is that departments don't control their own money. They earn it, but they then have to go, often cap in hand, to universities to ask the university to be allowed to spend their own money. So departments will always have to bid for jobs from the university on the basis of full costings. And different universities have different processes here, which feeds through into different types of posts being advertised. Now, some universities will just want to see that the post is affordable within the department's overall budget. this is what happened in my old university at Birmingham, for instance. That if we could show that our income significantly outstripped our costs by the total of what it would take to employ a new lecturer, we were given that position. And that position was then down to our discretion as a department to work out where we wanted to make that strategic investment into our own department. So, given that the department had the discretion about how to advertise the new post, this tended to lead to generic lectureship adverts, saying that we're looking for a highly qualified person and we don't really care what area it's in. So it would be an open advert and everyone can apply and we'll just take who we think the best person for the job is. So a much more open advert process. Now, that's not how it works in most universities, however. Other universities, and this one is a good example of this, will insist that any new post is cost recoverable in its own terms. So not just in terms of the broad departmental finances, but cost recoverable in its own terms. In other words, it has to be able to pay for itself. And if it doesn't pay for itself, then the university will not give the department its own money to spend on making an appointment. And because you have to demonstrate this before the post is agreed, it's always going to be the case at universities like ours that posts are advertised in a particular area. Departments have no choice in this. It will be a lectureship in X or Y. It will be a lectureship in security studies, or a lectureship in international political economy, or a lectureship in political theory. And there's no mix and matching across those. If you were to find, for instance, that you're appointing an international political economist and a political theorist on the same day, and you've got two stellar political theorists there, and all of your international political economists are completely useless, we're still not allowed to appoint the two political theorists who are clearly the best people that we've seen that day. We have to appoint one political theorist to the political theory job and one international political economist to the OPE job. And this is by far the most likely sort of advert that you will be responding to. Designated lectureships in particular subject areas. So a lectureship in X or in Y rather than an open lectureship. It's much, much, much more likely that you'll be applying for lectureships in that way. And I think that this means you'll stand the best chance of making it onto an interview shortlist if your research CV is clearly themed relative to that field. For instance, you could have 6 publications in hardcore strategic studies journals. But that's not going to put you above anyone for a political theory post who has 1 publication in a reputable political theory journal. That you might have more on your CV, but you just don't fit the characteristics of this particular job. And because of this, I think even at this stage, you must think about the possibility of making tactical decisions of how to present yourself, how to present your CV, how to present your research. Now, there are obvious ways of doing this. Firstly, when you do start to cut your teeth on journal publishing, think very seriously about which journals you target and how those journals send a particular message about the type of scholar that you perceive yourself to be. Here's an example. It's a well-reputed top 10 journal, the Review of International Political Economy. What would it say about how you're trying to theme your CV if you get a piece of work out in the Review of International Political Economy? I think quite clearly that the conclusion that shortlisting committees are going to draw is that you very definitely think of yourself as an international political economist. So there will be no question in the minds of shortlisting committees as to whether you would fit a post that was advertised specifically in international political economy, say. So think very seriously when you send articles off to journals about what this does in terms of your CV. I think the same is true of your PhD although to a lesser extent, I guess, which perhaps means that strategic decisions have to be made, or at least contemplated, when writing your PhD introduction, or also when writing your literature review chapter. Positioning yourself with respect to a particular literature, which gives you a particular profile as against that literature. So most PhD questions can be set up in a number of different ways, that there will be different bodies of literature which they could conceivably talk to. And it might be, and I often dislike myself for saying this as well, it might be that you have to make strategic decisions that are not primarily to do solely with intellectual questions, but are to do with job market implications about how you present your work in relation to a particular field, to show that you belong within that field. Because if this means that you're presenting yourself in line with a field that's shown significant growth in numbers of jobs in the last few years, and that growth is projected to continue, then this presumably gives you more chance of self-marketing in a way that will aim you towards some of these growth areas of the subject field. And I know that this sounds naturally instrumental, and it certainly wasn't the sort of issue that I had to wrestle with when I was writing my PhD. But the more that I see the developments within the field, the more that I think I do my own PhD students a disservice if I don't at least raise these questions with them and allow them to make their own minds up on it. So that's another way of theming yourself to potential job adverts. Because when we get to the shortlisting committee stage, one of the most frequently had discussions over people's CVs are, this looks really good, this looks really interesting, they've got lots on their CV, here comes the but. But do they really fit the terms of this job? Are they really a security studies specialist? Are they really a political theorist? Are they really an international political economist? And being able to close down those doubts by the way that you project yourself into the profession, I think, is a very good thing to do. Now then, how do you apply for a job? What counts as a job application? What are you required to submit? Well, in general, it's only two things: your research CV and a cover letter. And that's it. So not a great deal of information. Some people send through endless bits of written work and you receive application packs that are almost that thick. But what you're asked to submit is just a research CV and you have the option of a cover letter. Now, in terms of the research CV, the case it makes for you and for your candidature for the job will stand or fall by what's on there. And this isn't really anything that you can do anything about at the stage at which it becomes time to make the application. If it's got a load of publications on there, fantastic. If it's not got any publications on there, it might not succeed. In fact, it's probably likely not to succeed. There's nothing you can really do to massage the message, because the message comes out simply from the publications. Having said that, I saw one application for this last lot of jobs that had the same... this person was, I think, a quarter author of a respectable piece within a top 10 ranked journal, but had managed to list this one article in four different ways on the CV. Cutting out most of the co-authors from all but one of the listings. Yes, this is fraud. and no, we weren't fooled. So you can't do things like that. So your CV almost speaks for itself. And yes, you should take your time to prepare and present it professionally. You cannot imagine what a bad message it sends when you get handwritten application forms in this day and age to sift through. Honestly, they might as well just go in the bin, but you have to be professional and read through it. But present it properly, take your time, but at the same or by the same token, no amount of fancy presentation skills will make up for the fact that there are no journal articles there to list, if that is the case. So your CV, you can't really do a great deal about that. That's something you build up, not in the week that you're making the job application, but in the 2 years beforehand. So that's why thinking of publication strategy is sensible from now and from now on. Now, the cover letter, this is probably a bit more interesting in this respect. There's some scope here for making a case for yourself. And you make a case for yourself in two distinct ways. Firstly, by showing that you fit the terms of the job. So if there is some equivocation in your own CV as to whether you're a specialist in the field in which the job is advertised, you should use the cover letter to close down any of that equivocation, to make it entirely clear that you are actually a specialist in that field, and that's the field that you consider yourself to be operating in, and this is how you demonstrate it. You are much more likely to convince a shortlisting committee to give you an interview for a job if you've done that well on the cover letter. The second thing is that you should show that you meet the job specifications. Now, job specifications are put together by human resources departments, and they love to present applicants with a 48-page job spec list, which just goes on and 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 on. However, when it comes down to it, the job specifications are quite routine and standard and quite anodyne as well. They will say that what they're looking for in the successful candidate is, surprise, surprise, evidence of research excellence, evidence of teaching excellence, and I suppose hardly any academics are actually administratively excellent, so they'll cope with administratively competent, I think. So that's what they're looking for. And if you can demonstrate that there are either evidence or potential for you to tick the boxes in terms of research excellence, teaching excellence, that's what you should be focusing the content of your cover letter on. So that's how you apply. Once you apply, the deadline passes, the department goes and picks up all of the applications from HR, and then a shortlisting committee is convened. A shortlisting committee will usually involve 4 or 5 members of the department, either the people who work specifically in that subject area, because they will have the specialist knowledge to know what counts as good publications, what counts as an interesting CV, interspersed with some of the more senior people within the department whose seniority brings a certain sense of authority with it. The shortlisting committee will go through all of the applications. They will spend most of their time, 80% of their time, looking at and talking about publications and what the publication profile suggests about the applicant more generally. Publication profile is actually, and this is probably regrettable as well, is actually more important than how intrinsically interesting your research is. You might think that that's the wrong way round, but given what we're market tested against, given that so much of our research income is generated from our position within research league tables, and research league tables are dominated by research outputs, then we check the research outputs first rather than whether the research itself is intrinsically interesting. And as shortlisting committees, we will then invite probably no more than 4 people to interview. So if you get an interview for a job, you've done extremely well. Think of those poor old political theorists. 96 of them, we interviewed only 4. 92 bit the dust at the application stage. Weren't even invited in so they could show us exactly what they were made of. That was how severe the competition was there. And you should have seen some of the CVs off the top end of the 92 that didn't get an invite for an interview. Very, very good. and still we couldn't bring them in. Now, what about the interview itself? Well, the interview itself will formally only have one stage, but in practice has two stages. The first stage is a presentation to the department, and this can be a very nerve-wracking experience that you've been getting increasingly nervous about the whole prospect of going for this job interview that could be the make or break of your whole career, and then you wait outside in a corridor for half an hour beforehand, then you're invited into a room and you suddenly see a bunch of academics sitting around the desk looking a bit tetchy because they're required to be in this meeting room and not doing whatever else that they've got to do that morning. And it can be really, really scary. To be absolutely honest, you've got to come in and make the case about your own research. And in general, you'll be invited to talk about the broad themes and aims of your research. And you should have done your homework so that you can attach those broad themes and aims of your research. Tell the story of your unfolding research narrative in such a way that it looks as though it fits with the department that you're trying to get to employ you. Now, don't do what somebody did this time at our presentation stage and just puts a PowerPoint up with the names of, 15 of us in the department saying, well, I think I could work with you. I think I could work with you. I think I could work with you. Just bonkers. Talk about those themes and allow the people within the room subsequently to decide for themselves that you seem to be the sort of person that they can envisage working with. What you don't want is to be told that by a candidate. I will be working with you and you will give your time to make sure that my research comes up to scratch. Because if you give that sort of message, the only thing that goes through the minds of the people in that room is, next! Because you don't need that sort of person within the department. So that's what the interview does. It's solely about your work. So conference papers are a really, really good preparation for that. Firstly, because they get you used to stepping into that nerve-wracking atmosphere where you've got to talk about your work in front of a room full of people who you don't know, and you don't necessarily know who they are. You might be aware of a lot of their names, but you can't match names to faces. That can be slightly unsettling. So conference papers, because it takes you through the same process, I think that's useful as a form of practice. And you've got to convince them that your work is interesting. And I think you also have to convince them that you have more in your locker than merely an exceptionally good PhD project. You've got to be able to show how your PhD project itself unfolds into a broader programme of research. So to be able to outline some of the implications coming from your PhD research and your PhD conclusions that subsequently can form the basis of additional research projects. Yeah, so the difference between an unfolding programme of research that merely starts with your PhD and having a wonderful PhD project, but you can't think your way out of that. You can imagine that in the music world, I believe it's called the tricky second album syndrome. Yeah, what do you do after the success of the first album? And the same thing happens very much with lots of academics as well. Their first album is their PhD. They do their PhD. Their PhD is wonderfully accomplished. They don't know what to do beyond that. They don't know how to move on beyond that to keep going into the medium term with a broader programme of research. So that's something that you have to impress upon them. Now, that will usually take place in the morning. You don't get very long with this. Our last lot of presentations were only half an hour per candidate. 15 minutes of them talking, 15 minutes of us asking questions. Not long at all. Got to convince these people that you might be the right type of person to be employed to work with them for possibly 20 or 25 years on the basis of that half an hour. So you can see why the pressure's on, and you can see why lots of people, to be honest, don't perform very well in the presentations. I think it's more unusual to find someone who does perform well. And you think, what's wrong with them? Why weren't they as nervous as they should have been? So I think we go in expecting people to underperform and just hope they do as well as possible and then see what we can take out of that. Now, in the afternoon comes the formal interview. Now, legally, all universities have to say that this is the only thing that counts towards the decision. However, if you completely bomb out at the presentation stage and the department's had a chat afterwards and say that you are unappointable in any circumstances at all, irrespective of how well you do at the interview panel, I'm afraid, will not appoint you. So if you do completely bomb out at the presentation stage, you're toast. But legally, it's only the formal interview that actually counts towards the decision. The formal interview and the research CV, so and the application. Now, the formal interview themselves is surprisingly short. 30 minutes maximum is all that I've known. And they fly through 30 minutes. It's incredibly intense. And you're always asked whether you've got any questions for the interview panel at the end. And I've only ever had two academic interviews, both of which actually have been in this department. And both times I said, "Is that it?" That was my question. Not a very good question, not a very sophisticated question. But I couldn't believe that 30 minutes had already passed, and that's what you'll find. It absolutely flies. Also, you might be surprised at just how many people are there in the room with you. How many people does it take to ask you questions for a half-hour interview, you will think? And then times it by two, probably. I've never been in an interview, either sitting this side of the desk being interviewed or that side of the desk being part of the interview panel, when there have been less than six people in the room. Yeah. When I got interviewed for my job here that I actually did accept, so the second time, I walked in and there were 13 people around the table. Admittedly, this is for a senior level position rather than a junior level position, but nonetheless, I wondered why have they organised it for the council chamber, which can conceivably seat about 60 people around the big table. And then I found out because there were all these people there. Now, the division of labour amongst the panel members is routinely applied, whereby it's decided beforehand who's going to ask what type of questions. And for the sake of equity, we have to ask the same types of questions to all of the candidates. Now, this means that you can pretty much guess the sorts of questions that are going to come up. You can guess those questions and prepare yourself for them. I'm not really sure there's anything that should completely catch you unawares. Okay, the whole situation might catch you unawares, and simply being there might be too much for you to control your nerves, and therefore things might start to go wrong. But in terms of what's actually asked, I think you should be able to preempt or second guess those questions. So these are the types of questions that you get asked. The first question is always asked by the most senior person there, which is often going to be a Pro Vice Chancellor or a Dean of Faculty, something like that. And they will always ask something along the lines of, why do you want the job? By that they mean, what is the attraction of our department? And there are obviously good ways and bad ways of answering that. Don't be too fawning, but make it clear that the way that you see your own career progressing, that a move to that particular department would be a good thing. Even if you have it in your mind that that's only going to be a stepping stone while you get yourself a more prestigious job, tell them still that it would be a very good thing for your career to move there. And don't tell them about the stepping stone thoughts that are in your mind, because that often doesn't go down very well with people. The second set of questions is about you and your career development. You'll be asked where you see yourself in 5 years' time. And the answer to that one is not, well, obviously I'm a complete genius, so I will be at professorial level at the University of Cambridge in 5 years' time, and there are no two ways about that. What they really mean is, how do you envision your research CV having moved on? So that gives you a chance to talk about the sorts of journals that you would want to most most happily publish in. Moving from PhD into writing a research monograph on the basis of the PhD, talking about professional development in other ways. So that sort of thing. So to allow you the chance to describe a trajectory whereby it seems firstly manageable on the basis of what's already on your CV, but still has those aspirations for you to really push yourself as far as you can. The third set of questions, you're always going to ask a short series of questions about the content of your research, but only a short set of questions about that. More often than not, it will be asking you to position yourself in relation to a particular field, to show the way that you respond to and interact with discussions, debates that are at the forefront of the field in which you're applying for that job. So if it's a job in international relations theory, you'll be asked about the relation of your work to some of the cutting-edge debates within international relations theory. That's one of the ways of seeing whether you're going to be able to join in with those debates, whether you're going to be a bit of a player on the scene, whether you're going to be able to project yourself into the debate in a way whereby your voice in that debate becomes an important one, and the department can then reflect in the glory of the institutional affiliation that you have with the department. Fourth set of questions are always about teaching. How would you fit into the existing teaching? How would you envisage your contribution to the programmes that are already on the books? How might you develop modules to supplement what's already on the books? Whether you show an awareness of the significance of self-generated income through taught programmes and how you might be able to innovate to bring on board new programmes, maybe the MA level, that will be new sources of income for the department. Okay, that sounds instrumental as well, but it's something that departments like to hear. It shows that you're in tune with what the demands of the academic job are, and those demands are not just sitting in your office and writing papers or standing in front of students and giving lectures. It's about planning for the future of the department more broadly. The fifth set of questions is always about admin, and these are concluded very quickly, because usually the question is, would you be prepared to do the admin that we would ask you to do? And you're not going to say no to that question in a job interview, are you? So that's a fairly standard question. And the sixth and last one, I've seen people trip up on this. It often goes back to the chair of the panel, the most senior person there, who will ask, "And would you take the job if we offered it to you?" And some people say, and you're sitting there thinking, no, clearly the answer that you should have been giving was just yes. Even if you don't mean it, you have to say it. And that hesitation can undermine the performance that they've given in the whole of the rest of the interview. Now, in general, those six people on the interview panel, it will be somebody at university level, either a Pro Vice Chancellor or the Dean of the Faculty. They're in charge. They're the only person who can authorise that a job offer is made to one of the candidates. So if they decide that all the candidates are unappointable, the job will not be filled in that particular round of interviews. Then you will always have the head of the department making the appointment. You will always have an external person, somebody from a different department, who will often ask questions about interdisciplinarity. There's a word, eh? And about your willingness to talk to people outside of your own department and of your own discipline. You will then have a number of other senior figures from the department in which you're hoping to be appointed. There will probably be three other professors in the room to go along with that. There will always be somebody, a secretary to the appointment panel, taking the notes. And there will often be someone from HR there as well, So I think you would expect, even for a junior level appointment, to have a room with seven people in there. And it's all over a lot more quickly than you would think. And they hope to make the decision on the same day and inform the winning candidate that evening. But winning candidates don't often say yes straight away. They often take the offer back and start haggling. So you might get a phone call 2 or 3 days later if the winning candidate is not you but has turned down the post because they've done some dealing back at home. And you might, in one sense, be the second choice but still get offered the job. So it's not until you finally find out and you're informed by the head of department that the job has been offered to someone else and they have accepted it. It's not until that point that the game's finally up if you haven't got the position. And that, as far as I'm aware anyway, is probably as much as I can tell you for now about that process. But I'm aware that a lot of you are likely to have questions. My next lot of meetings don't start till 3:30, so I've still got the best part of half an hour if you want to fire any questions at me. Even if they sound like daft questions, if there's anything that I haven't explained or you just don't know about, you can bet your bottom dollar that somebody else in the room has got exactly the same question but just isn't brave enough to ask it. So please do ask me anything along these lines and I will give you my honest answer.
Maybe from your experience, if you have two candidates and one of them has, let's say, like a few publications in various journals, but not of the top ones, and another one has maybe one or two publications, so significantly less publications in terms of numbers, but in a much more established journal. So what's then the kind of decision process about?
At the shortlisting stage, I think the decision would be to invite both of them for an interview. And then if they were still to perform absolutely equally all the way through the day, and I think you would hope that one would clearly outperform the other, I suspect that in most cases, the person that would get the job there... What do the rest of you think?
More prestigious journal.
Yeah. I think that's where my vote would go every time. If everything else was absolutely equal and I was sitting on that interview panel, I would go for the person who's shown that they have the potential already to be hitting the very top journals. Because that's very rare. You wouldn't think that that person would ever lose that ability. Whereas the other person, even if they've got 5 or 6 pieces out, still needs to be able to demonstrate that they do have that ability to go up the next level. Ben?
Does that mean that there's a danger of publishing too much in journals that are not good enough? So after, I mean, because the shortlisting committee could think that this person has tried really hard but hasn't been able so far to climb the ladder.
That's a really good question, and one that is certainly something that I wrestled with in terms of my own career development. I think I made a conscious decision to try to write fewer things, but to make sure I was satisfying myself more with the quality of the work that I was producing. I have to be honest, though, I was doing that within the context of already having a permanent post, so that was an easier decision for me to make on those grounds. There are other disciplines. My friends in the economics department, they have this concept of CV pollution, and they think that the only things that you put on your CV, even if you have more publications than that, are the ones that send the right sort of message about target journals. So you could get a hugely well paid professorial position in economics, for instance, with just two journal articles, or two journal articles that you would be willing to admit to having on your CV. Honestly, some of them just cut all the rest of them. They deny that they're there because that's what they want their CV to say. Now, it's rather different, I think, in our subject field. I'm not really sure that's that whole notion of publishing too much comes into play with us. But you're right that there's a clear opportunity cost. If you're just going for quantity in the first instance, then that probably means that there are fewer opportunities for you to focus primarily on quality. So I think there is a trade-off between the two. At the same time, though, what is the most sensible person looking to get themselves on shortlisting through the shortlisting committee stage and on to the interview stage in the first place? You're always told, and you're told this always because it's true, that getting stuff out is what counts. And so if you think, well, I'm not necessarily guaranteed to get everything accepted for publication, so I'm almost going to carpet bomb the journals with loads and loads and loads of stuff, and then it all comes out, what do you do then? Well, you should never apologise for that or try to hide those. It's a very complex position to be in. It's maybe one of those things, Ben, that, to be honest, you shouldn't think too much about. You can over-intellectualise it and get to the point at which you then decide you don't know what to do for the best. Whereas I think if you just make progress, continue to write, be doing things on the PhD, trying to write articles on the side, then hopefully if you get into that sort of routine, then all the other things about career development in effect look after themselves. And once you're in the position where you've got your feet under the table and you've got your job, then you can begin to make the next set of decisions about exactly what sort of message further down the line you want your CV to send. But there's nothing to be lost by having, in effect, too many publications at the stage at which you're applying for your first permanent post. James?
I think two questions. The first stage of the interview, is there any particular structure to that from your experience in terms of, do the academics in the room tend to be quite aggressive, maybe the wrong term, but trying to really critique and challenge what people are saying, or just trying to find out more information? And the second question is, where, if at all, would you place as an applicant work you've done outside of academia, in terms of if you've done partnership work research-wise with private sector, public sector, or even paid employment consultancy? Does that have a place at all in the application process? Mm.
Let me deal with them one at a time. Obviously I have to, otherwise I would be saying two sentences at the same time. It wouldn't make sense, would it? The first question about, remind me the first question so I get it spot
first
on.
Half of the interview,
yeah.
Is there any particular structure from your experience in terms of, do the academics in the room, are they quite probably as much as trying to critique and trying to challenge you, or is it more of a trying to get more information about your work in a general sense?
Very much the latter, with one or two exceptions. Interestingly, in the last place that I worked, we were all had to show up 5 minutes before the presentations were started, and every time we were reminded by our heads of department that this is not an attempt for you, or not an opportunity for you to show that you're cleverer than the candidates. This is for you to try to tease out of the candidates exactly where the limits of their argument and their abilities lie. And we were told that we would get in trouble if we definitely went in and tried to do a job on them. You can see sometimes that that can happen accidentally. I know in the last series of presentations, I certainly asked a couple of questions in a gentle, friendly way, and then the clearly had got right to the nerve of the candidate's work, and the candidate crumbled in the answer, and I think in both instances proved themselves to be unappointable. And so at one level it's good that you know that, but at another level I still felt that I was shifting around because I felt uncomfortable having done it, even though I could certainly satisfy myself that I hadn't stepped over the mark or anything like that. So I think in general you will find that people will be less likely to take the sorts of positions that they take in academic seminars, where they might think, bit of rough and tumble coming here, let's see what they're made of. You don't get that sense of people locking horns, which is a good thing. You've got to respect the candidates and the situation that the candidates find themselves in. It can be very distressing for people. I remember staying overnight here before my first job interview, and I was in the next door room to one of the people that I was being interviewed against, and she was up all night physically throwing up in the toilet. And that's how much the whole process was already getting to her before she started. Imagine what a bundle of nerves she would have been when she walked through the door. That just a terrifying position to be in, and you've got to respect that. They're highly charged rooms for the presentations, because you feed off the nerves that the people themselves are emitting. If you've ever, I don't know whether any of you have, if you've ever had to do any invigilating, I get nervous when I'm invigilating. I get nervous when I'm invigilating, not because, I might not be able to walk around the table and hand somebody an extra answer book, or I might forget where the toilets are when I go to the door and point them in that direction. I get nervous because you're feeding back and reflecting back the nerves that the students themselves are placing onto you. So I think everyone, with one or two possible exceptions, that everyone knows what the limits are that you don't transgress in that environment. Because it's difficult enough as it is for the candidates without willfully aggressive behaviour on the parts of the academic staff, making it even more difficult. And now I can't remember what your second question was.
Place, if anywhere, is there for outside academic work, because someone's had a career beforehand, or because they've done research in part of the public private sector, you've been paid consultancy work, does that come into the application process?
Yeah, I think it does, but it will do so differently depending on the specifications of the job. If, for instance, you're applying for a job in international relations theory with a definite preference for appointing an abstract Foucauldian, then this makes it look as though it's a purely theoretical person that is being looked for. If the job specification is for a job in public policy aiming to assist the department in meeting their impact agenda targets, then if you've got that sort of beyond academic experience and it brings a network of contacts into the department's remit that helps them meet those targets, then that will be looked upon extremely positively. And okay, I've given you two, I think, extreme examples of the one side and the other, and most jobs fit somewhere in between. But it's part of the story, I presume, James. It's part of the story, if you have those experiences, of who you are and the sort of academic that you've become. And so I would certainly never encourage anyone to hide those, because it's part of them. And so you want them to be able to show themselves as authentically as possible. Okay, by placing them in such an alien set of circumstances that their knees are knocking and they're trembling even before they get through the door. But beyond that, you hope that people will be able to show themselves authentically within that process.
Thanks very much for demystifying the process.
I've probably just scared you to death, I have.
I think I was pretty. I saw a CV of one of the candidates who didn't get shortlisted, so I my eyes were fully open before coming in, because it was very impressive. The question was more for other people's benefit, actually, because I've given up entirely. your advice, obviously, it could apply to any field, any career. Is, you know, if you get into a rogue field, then you're going to be in a much better position than if you're getting into one that's sort of dead man's shoes, or if it's declining. And you mentioned, you know, the example of security being something that was a growth area in recent times, but I suppose perhaps more for the first year PhDs out there, what do you consider will be the growth areas in a few years' time, because they've still got the chance to sort of tailor their research slightly towards those growth areas?
I don't think it's going to change much, Doug, from what we've seen over the last 10 years. I think because of the two reasons that I cited at the beginning, that this clearly seems to be where the Research Council agenda is. The Research Council in our area, the Economic and Social Research Council, the ESRC, is forever getting it in the neck from successive Secretaries of State for Education for not funding enough research that contributes directly to the public policy making process within the UK. And it's responded to that by saying, well, what are the big public policy issues? Security. So we'll have security, conflict and justice as a strategic challenge area for the next 5 years. And I presume that that will just get rolled on. In the same way in the late 1990s, when it was a very different international climate, guess what was the big public policy issue that then generated so much of the output of funded ESRC work? Globalisation. So in a sense, the growth areas themselves, certainly in the way that the Research Council projects them, will follow the news. So those things that we believe are going to be the big public policy areas will continue to be the growth areas, particularly because they overlap with where it's most possible to put on the self-generating income MA programmes. Just look around in our department. What have we got now? We've got, was it 154 MA students this year? If you put the international relations, IPE and security studies students together, I think that was about 125 of them. So that tells you a lot about the sources of self-generated income that are coming into the department, and that's then likely to feed through into the sorts of additional posts that are made available, because we can go to the university and say, this is our income stream, this is how we project it will change in the next few years. We think that this is justification for a new post in this particular area. So I suspect that they will be the same as over the last 10 years, which means that there will be certain areas which will perhaps almost entirely die out. I can't remember the last time there was a lectureship advertised in British politics. So many departments used to have, it's the UK system after all, used to have as a core component of their undergraduate degree programmes at least one module in British politics, if not a module in British politics at every level. And now most of those have gone. The people that were teaching those modules have retired. It's a generational shift. And when replacement appointments have been made, they've been shifted over from British politics into areas where the department thinks that more money can be made. So British politics is, there's nobody here doing British politics, are there? British politics is almost dead on its feet, I'm afraid. And lots of the big British politics departments like Sheffield and Essex, two of the top four ranked departments, so these are good departments, they produce lots of PhD students in British politics. Nowhere to go. No jobs at all. They end up either in working somewhere around the Westminster Village in one of the think tank or policy advice centres, or they end up teaching politics at ALO. So that's pretty much gone. There's not much growth in comparative politics in this country. We seem to not have had that move into comparative politics for exactly the same reason, that those sources of income coming into the departments are not sufficiently well attuned to justify that sort of spending on comparative politics, it does tend to be the specialist areas that have the word international in front of them, which is where the biggest growth sectors are.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. That was really interesting. Just a few kind of questions, I guess, if we've sort of almost exhausted the...
Okay, hit me with them one at a time, though, because given just how well I responded to James by forgetting both of his by trying to remember the other one, it might be one of those days for me where I can only keep one thing in mind at one go. So.
Okay. The first one's probably the easiest one, so...
Oh, good, yeah, start there.
When you get down to the... You know, you said normally departments invite 4 people for the interview.
Mm.
I'm guessing it sort of depends on the context and the job and stuff, but is it often the case that people generally have someone that they quite fancy and they're just bringing in a few other people just to, you know, see what happens, or...
The insider candidate phenomenon. It happens... it happens because legally every job has to be fully and openly advertised, and there can be occasions in which there's a very clear evidence that that's exactly what's happened. I remember one of my peers from my PhD programme days. He had an enormous run of bad luck that he went for, I think it was 4 job interviews over the course of one term, and he came second on all of them to an inside candidate. And at that stage, he really wondered whether he was just going to give up, because it was soldier's guide to continue to be in that position, where actually you were being told by everyone that was there that you were the best candidate, but they've still gone for the inside candidate because the job was always meant for the inside candidate. Our university is very different than that. It makes it almost impossible for us to shortlist people with an existing Warwick affiliation. We have to go over and above to make the case specifically to allow those people to be included. But it's definitely the case that from time to time you do trip up on a favoured internal candidate. I think the fact that departments know that they're not going to have as many appointments in the next couple of years as they might have been used to 5 or 6 years ago. I think that actually makes the insider candidate phenomenon less of a problem, because they know that if they introduce a half-baked process simply to get someone in position, then that might very well be exhausting all the possible appointments they can make in that area for the next 5 or 6 years until the financial situation normalises itself. And also, you get more, these days you get more oversight of appointments from on high. So university central command will, I know this happened to Ben, he got dragged in, got told, we are watching you and you will be making appointments that measurably increase your ref submission. And if they don't, and that sentence was never finished, but there were lots of dots on the end, it was made very clear to him that that was the only agenda in town. And that if we didn't play by that one, then there would be no more money that was going to be given to us in this ref period for other appointments.
Okay, I mean, on my own personal experience, when I was applying for ESRC quota awards, and I kind of found out that in about 5 of the cases I was second to someone that was like within house kind of thing, you know. So I was just wondering how much of an issue it was in terms of like academic jobs or
I think it's slightly different, because at that PhD competition level, it will mean that the people that are already in-house are likely to have more access to academic members of staff that will help them put the application together, whereas that advantage disappears when it comes to applying for academic jobs, because anyone can tell you from inside or outside the department how to write the cover letter, and then the CV speaks for itself. So you're not going to get that same sort of what the PhD at competition level is usually an accidental privileging. You might get the deliberate privileging, but I think that's a phenomenon that was probably more obvious 10 years ago than it is now. I think universities have just become more professional in that respect, so they don't know that.
Okay. The next one was just about the interviews, over and above what you've already said. Is there any sort of classic boo-boos, or are there any things that, you know, is there a sort of trend that you can sort of discern that, yeah, people that are generally successful tick these boxes or whatever?
Yeah, it's the people that are confident in their own research. And you have to show that you've got confidence in what you're doing, and that you think that what you're doing has some intrinsic importance, and you're willing to sit there and speak to people about the intrinsic importance of your research. Obviously, everyone's research is important to them, but being able to project that sense to someone else is often quite difficult. And it's the sort of thing that I keep trying to get everyone doing in the first year training class, to make sure that they get used to being able to present their own work in that way. I think one of the ways in which people fall down, so there are more ways of doing an interview wrong than there are of doing it right. One of the ways they fall down is to be overly fawning, to almost give the interview from being on their knees saying, please, please, please give me a job. That doesn't come down very well. The second way that people fall down is not doing their homework. So not being aware of what the department looks like and making claims about how they would fit in with the department, and you're looking around thinking, is that our department? We don't do that. So how does that make them fit in with us? I think another way that people fall down is that they think that their own conclusions are self-evident, and so don't like explaining to people on the interview panel why their conclusions are not self-evident but robust nonetheless. And if you imagine that out of the maybe six academic people that are around there, could be up to three that aren't specialists in that subject field. So you need to be able to move between being able to talk directly to the specialists, but also being able to talk to the non-specialists as well. And the best performances I've ever seen in interviews are the people that start talking to the specialists, but then almost re-explain what it is that they've just said for the non-specialists. And to be honest, if you are faced with somebody who can do that and has that skill instinctively, you think you're going to be a good teacher. Yeah, because that's the sort of skill that really helps you as a teacher, to be able to operate between different levels at the same time, being able to say the same things but to a different audience by capturing the same essential dynamic in the argument but in different ways. So I think those are the big pitfalls to avoid. Also, not making it clear that you envisage a job in that department as anything other than a stepping stone to a job somewhere else. And that so many people do that, and it just terrible. Gives out the wrong impression completely.
All right. I hate to jump in, but I seem to vaguely remember you said something that you had an appointment at 3:30.
Yeah, I have office hours. It sounds as though the corridor's getting full, doesn't it? So I presumably have lots of MA students wanting to see me about dissertations.
Right.
So I can stay here for another hour, I don't want to see.
That's a way to do it. No, well, maybe we had one question that was trying for quite a while in the back there. Maybe as a last question, and then we could...
Yeah, if you don't mind, just a quick question. You've discussed about publications, emphasize the publication quite a lot. I just wonder, is conference paper, would you consider conference paper in Young Careers CV as well? Do you expect to see that, or would you?
Well, it's nice to see that the early career scholars interact with professional networks of people, and they're building some sort of profile for themselves through the conference papers that they give. But a conference paper isn't on the same level as a publication, no. So that's a nice extra to have, as well as the publications. But having the publications is the most important thing.
Just one extra bit. Then would you see the rank between conferences to attend, do you think? I mean, is there some ranks between conferences, like priorities, like something A is better than B conference, for example?
No, I've never thought that that was particularly important when I've been doing shortlisting. I've thought that it's... I worry if people are applying for jobs and they've never been to a conference and that they've never really exposed their own work to that sort of public scrutiny that you get at conferences. But I don't look at that bit of CVs and think that one particular conference would be qualitatively more impressive than another one. I just think showing that you're attuned to that process of giving your work in public is the most important thing in general.
Thank you very much.
That's okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Did you have any more, Andy? No?